Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jones!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. What a great week it's been so far in the World T20 for England. Two wins out of two, and even better news, perhaps, for England. Ben Stokes is going to the Ashes. You've probably picked up that over the last few days, the story that Ben's now in nets and really getting earnest about his Ashes campaign. His finger has cleared up and so has his other issues. So that's great news for England. And actually, they're at the moment blazing a trail in the World T20 as well, Simon. And I know you've been covering a few of the matches with the BBC, and well, they're not. I wouldn't say they're necessarily the team to beat, because actually Pakistan have been probably the most exciting team so far. And it's quite interesting to see in the group stages, in the groups that Pakistan are in, India are second from bottom at the moment, though, of course, they have only played one game. And oddly, they're not playing again for quite a few days. So they're going to be bottom for quite a while, given they were originally the favourites for the tournament. And of course, they still could easily win it. But it's quite an interesting situation.
Well, I predict that's going to change, Oz. I still think India will be in the semi-finals. Although they do have to be careful. If they lose to New Zealand, they are in real problems in this group. And it's sort of what happens when you have a group with two weakish sides in it, Namibia and Scotland, one moderate side in Afghanistan, and three strong sides. In a strange way, England are in a better group because you feel everyone could beat everyone. So you might need fewer wins to qualify for the semi-finals. You might not. We'll see how it plays out. It's too early to say at the moment. But India have got a really significant game coming up against New Zealand. If they were to lose that, then you could see them not qualifying for the semi-finals, even if they were to go on and win all their other games. So they're on a bit of a tightrope, really. You might say it's sort of bizarrely, sort of like an early quarter-final almost. But you know, I would expect them to overcome New Zealand. And I mean, what about England though? They've won two. They, you know, not guaranteed anything yet, but they've done it so comfortably so far. They just knocked off the West Indies. They knocked off Bangladesh. It's almost just like you're brushing them away, isn't it? Like, you know, just brushing a bit of dust off your clothes. It's been so straightforward for them so far. They're bound to be bigger challenges to come, and they've got Australia next.
Yes, I agree, and I think that the interesting thing is that you thought when you looked at that 2019 World Cup team, was it possible to improve? And incidentally, we've got, talking of the 2019 World Cup team, we have Liam Plunkett on this show later in the second half. He was our guest in the Virtual Cricket Club last night, and he talks about the success of that World Cup team and why they were so good and what was behind their success in a way. But just going to this team now, this current side, they have improved, I think, not necessarily by new personnel, but just by adaption. And two people I'll pick out, Moeen Ali, clearly, who's been bowling in the power play. And I think in that first match against West Indies, we're probably only going to bowl one over. But Owen Morgan spied uncertainty in the batting and also confidence in Moeen's bowling and kept him going. And he took two key wickets and a very good catch as well, and really undermined the West Indies in that first match. And then bowling well against Bangladesh, kept him going again. He got two key wickets there. So the performance of Moeen Ali, which I think was partly on the back of a very good performance in the IPL, feeling comfortable in those conditions, knowing the pitches, knowing the environment, having been out in the UAE for a couple of weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, with his Chennai Super Kings team, who, of course, won the IPL. And he is the first Englishman to have played in a team that won the IPL. So that must have really helped his confidence coming into this tournament. And the other player I'd pick out is Jason Roy, who, you know, we all know his amazing ability to hit power-hitting fast bowlers and bludgeon it to the boundary. But his weaknesses against spin have always been a little bit fairly obvious. And I think he's coped with those really well and found new options. He knows that teams are now going to open with spin, and he's found a new route to productivity, which is impressive.
Yeah, he's been working on it, hasn't he? He said he's been working with Liam Dawson. He's got Liam Dawson to bowl a lot at him. He's in the squad, left armer, and you know he's in the party out there in the UAE. He's been working with Liam Dawson. Yeah, because he knows that's what they're going to do. And actually, if you look at his stats against spin, that they're not actually that bad. You know, he really has improved. So you know, that's a major plus for England, because it's that sort of default position that teams have. Oh yeah, bowl spin at Jason Roy in the power play. But if you know, that's great. A player spots a potential weakness in their game, works really hard at it, and then when the pressure's on, potentially, you know you can deal with it because you've practiced so much. It's that whole thing, isn't it? About practice. You know, it really helps him. And yesterday, came out and batted really well, 61. It's quite a tame first over from Shakib, and England got away. And I mean, there was no tension in the game at all. No threat from Bangladesh. Same with West Indies in the opening game. That must have been a huge lift for England that first game to beat a potentially tricky side like the West Indies. Just take them down like that, and then Bangladesh is probably, you know, if you want the right opponents for the next game, probably Bangladesh are those opponents, the weakest side in the group, and you win there as well. And suddenly you've got two wins. Also, your net run rate is really strong as well. So if it was a situation where teams were level on points, so England are so far ahead on net run rate, you know, they've had two thumping wins, so they've got a little advantage there as well. So they, you know, they can drop a game, possibly even drop two games and still qualify. We don't quite know how everything's going to work out and who beats who.
I was very disappointed with the West Indies. And I think it proves that the way they played, that you do have to evolve. It's not good enough to just say, well, the way we play is we might soak up a few dot balls, but then we hit some sixes and catch up. That is not the way to go on some of these grounds, because they are quite big playing areas. And say Abu Dhabi, for instance, quite a big surface. And you can't just catch up with a few sixes. They should have been more calculating, but they sort of stuck to their plans of, no, we feel we're strong enough to clear the ropes and stuff. And they were, you know, 55 all out. You've got to evolve. You know, teams know what you're going to, how you're going to try and play. So you've got to be clever. You've got to be smart. And they weren't, which is disappointing. And England are evolving. And, you know, one other player I'll pick out, and this is kind of where I suppose Liam Plunkett's absence is a sort of benefit to England. It's allowed someone like Tamal Mills to come in, and he's a guy who can bowl in the middle overs and at the end, at the death, and is invaluable. And I think one great thing about him is, and we've seen it, you know, over his truncated career, the differential between his faster ball and his slower ball is immense. It's about 22 miles an hour. And that, if you can do that and bowl them with the same action and the same vigour, which he does, that's an invaluable tool.
Well, 3 for 27 and 2 for 17 so far. So 5 wickets, economy rate pretty good as well. He's had about as good a start, I think, he could possibly have hoped for. What do England do with, you know, Mark Woods not been fit. Tom Curran's not been fit. I don't see Curran playing much of a part unless England do have injuries to their main bowlers. But you know, Wood, I think, was sort of in the frame, definitely. How much of a concern is that as far as the Ashes are concerned, Mark Wood? He's missed a couple of games through an ankle injury. England might not change their side for the Bangladesh game as it was, but Joan Morgan made the point, yeah, Mark Wood's not fit. What about that? I mean, Jofra Archer's gone, Ollie Stone's gone.
But Ben Stokes is back. So
Ben Stokes is back, yeah.
Stokes is going to be bowling quite a few overs, I think, in the Ashes. Yeah, I mean, Mark, obviously Wood is a worry, but we've always known that, really. I mean, he's someone who can't really play two test matches back-to-back. And yeah, I mean, obviously, as soon as you have operations on an ankle or something, there are always going to be worries and likelihoods of reinfections or re-injuring those sort of areas. It's a shame. Maybe he'll be able to get through. I mean, I saw him running on the field yesterday carrying drinks or sweaters or something, or not sweaters, because they won't be wearing sweaters in the UAE, obviously, ice or something. And he looked all right.
He touched those eyes, Jos. You saw him bring his sweaters on.
Yeah. He looked quite sprightly, but I that's different from running into bowl and crashing his foot down on the hard concrete surface.
Yeah, well, he's missed two games. That's all we know so far. I mean, if England, I suppose, were really concerned, they might have ruled him out of the tournament and brought in a replacement. And that's happened for some players already. Bangladesh have dropped a bowler, haven't they? West Indies have dropped a bowler as well. So England haven't done that yet. So clearly, or at the moment, they feel that he's, you know, there is potential for him to play later in the tournament. So England have got Australia, Sri Lanka, and South Africa to play. And I mean, South Africa, they, what is it with them and world tournaments? Quinton de Kock pulling out of the game the other day, apologizing today in a statement, got an emotional statement as well, saying, you know, he apologizes for what happened the other day, not joining in with taking the knee. And this is something that South Africa, to me, it didn't seem they sorted out before the tournament. So
that's the point, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, there's a photograph of them the other day, and they all show this sort of symbol of unity in a different way. It's a very pointed photograph. You know, some players are taking the knee, some players are standing to attention, some players are a fist raised. And you know, de Kock told that he had to take the knee, and he refused, and then pulled out of the game, and now he's apologised. It's not a good look.
No,
for South Africa.
No, I mean, he said in a few lines in his statement, we had camps, we had sessions, we had Zoom meetings. We know where we all stand, and that is together. I think it would have been better for everyone concerned if we had sorted this out before the tournament started. Then we could have focused on our job to win cricket matches for our country. There always seems to be a drama when we go to World Cups. And that does seem to be very, very much the case. And if you think back to, you know, the 2015 World Cup, for instance, and losing that semi-final to New Zealand and having to change the team at the last moment, and, you know, AB de Villiers being captain and being told who he could replace someone with, and it just all causing kind of horrible issues. You know, these tournaments, taking aside the sort of whole political issue, the racial issue, these tournaments are finely balanced. All these teams are pretty close. The top teams are pretty close. You've got to be 100% focused on playing the game. And clearly, South Africa in that first match were all over the place. You know, sort of 80 for 7 or something like that. And they lost in the end. I mean, it was a bit closer than perhaps you would have predicted against Australia. But still, they looked a rabble. And, you know, whatever the issues are that cause that, if you're not all focused and you're not all together and you're being told things which some people want to do and some people don't, it's going to undermine your performance.
Yeah, although they did come back and beat West Indies very comfortably, actually, as it turned out, in their second match. So the game that de Kock missed, you know, all that what was going on behind the scenes in the lead up to that game, they did come out and win the game quite comfortably. Perhaps that says not a great deal for the West Indies, that, you know, as you've alluded to so far. So they played two games. You know, they are the defending champions. They've got players who've played a lot of T20 cricket. It's all, in a way, you sort of feel with West Indian cricket that it's their sort of main focus. That's where the big focus is from all their top players. They've got, you know, they've got a lot of talent, but they have not been able to harness it so far. And they really are teetering on the brink now. Played two, lost two. They need to win every game. I would have thought to have a chance of qualifying, even if they do, that might not be enough. Mm. But one team we haven't talked about, Yoz, is Pakistan.
Well, of course you want to talk about them because you clairvoyantly said,
well,
they're a dark horse. They've got a great chance here, and well, you've been proved correct.
Well, it's early days. I think we should.
But they do look very good.
They do look good. I expect them to play well. For all the reasons I outlined in the podcast last week when we were talking about that. You know, they are playing at their second home. They know the conditions. They've got lots of talent as well. But you know, somewhere along the line, it's going to be the same for England, Australia, or whoever, India, whoever qualifies for the semi-finals. You know, it's going to be one of those on the day. They've got two on the day performances, haven't they? To produce, and that clearly their semi-final opponent is going to be a difficult one, and they could easily stumble and fall a bit like England did against Pakistan, say in the Champions Trophy. Remember when they lost in 2017 to Pakistan? They had an awful day out in Cardiff, and it can happen on the day. What you hope is that your plans, your preparations, all your form and everything all comes together nicely, and that nice alchemy works, and it takes you to the final. But at the moment, I mean, two. So different types of victories for them. I mean, what a fantastic Philip to beat India by 10 wickets.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, amazing day. And, you know, one of the celebrations in Pakistan as well. The first time they've ever beaten India in a World Cup. Great for Pakistan. But also, it was a sort of big statement of intent as well. 10 wickets taking down India. And then a different sort of win against New Zealand, because at one point against New Zealand they looked a bit vulnerable. You thought, oh no, this is going to go wrong for them. This is Pakistan, you know, up one day, down the next. And that's become a bit of a cliche, but I was thinking about this morning. Isn't it sort of true of all international sides? They're a bit up and down. I mean, England are no different. You know, that they're up and then they're down. You know, they win a game and then they lose a game.
It's the nature of one day cricket, partly, isn't it? People can. You know, you haven't got any time to recover, especially in T20. You know, if you do collapse to 30 for four, it's not easy to come back. Obviously, in a longer format or a test match, you've got the second innings or the back half of the innings to try and recover yourself. So it isn't easy. And at times, you know, I'm just to finish, I mean, you know, if you get a good bowling spell, a Shane Shah Afridi or, you know, Moeen Ali taking a couple of early wickets, and it destabilizes you, it is not easy to come back in T20. Therefore, even a successful team can have dips.
Yeah, I'm not just referring to white ball cricket as well. It's the phrase that's used about Pakistan cricket in general. You never quite know what you're going to get. Well, England are no different from that. I mean, you know, they beat India by an innings at Headingley. They absolutely thrashed them. And then, you know, what happens in the next test match? You know, they lost the game. They you know, bowled out on the final day. And England are up and down. They had that incredible win against Australia at Headingley in 2019. What happened in the next match? They lost at Old Trafford and Australia retained the Ashes. So, yeah, you could. It's a funny. It's a label that's attached to Pakistan cricket. And you know, there is some truth in it. But I think it goes for all teams. Pakistan lost to the West Indies in the first test. In Jamaica, that amazing finish, but they came back and played brilliantly in the second Test match. But then England are capable of doing that, and so are South Africa, so are Australia, up and down as well. So it's
as I said at the beginning, in a way, you know, all these teams are quite closely matched, and it only takes one or two, you know, smart or scintillating performances to turn the tables. One thing I would say about Pakistan, I think, is a key person, and this sounds obvious, Babar Azam. Not only for his silky, sublime batting, and he just makes batting look so easy, but also I think his captaincy, I think his demeanour on the field. You know, there have been Pakistan captains of the last 10 years or so who have been a bit hot-headed, and even Kohli, I think, doesn't help his team's cause by looking kind of concerned and a bit anxious and perhaps occasionally angry when things don't go to plan. Obviously, this is Owen Morgan's great strength. His great asset is that composure, that sort of sang-froid that he has, you know, that you can't tell what he's thinking. And I think Baba's a bit like that too. He looks calm. He looks composed. He looks in control. And I think that's reassuring to the rest of his team.
Yeah. Is batting easy sometimes? You say player makes batting look easy. Do you think it is easy, or is it always a struggle for the, well, for the top players? Is it
I mean, yeah, I've asked a lot of players about that because clearly I don't have enough evidence of my own experience.
But you've written a book about that.
I would say that when your head is clear and you're just allowing your movements to dictate what happens and you're just focusing on the ball and you're not worrying about your trigger movements and your foot positions and who's bowling and, you know, various other things, you've got a clear mind. I think batting can be easy, yes. I think if you get into that rhythm, you look at some of the innings that Joe Root has played recently, he makes batting look ridiculously easy. And it's not easy at all. Absolutely not. Yeah. But when you're that skillful and you've got that clear mind, you can make it look easy.
Steve Smith made batting look pretty easy on the last Ashes tour. I remember him, you know, in Perth, for example. He just thought, this guy's going to bat forever. Now, so talking about Ashes, a neat segue onto Ben Stokes. He hasn't played much cricket for a lot of the year. The finger injury clearly was a major issue for him. I think it was, you know, it's horrible when you have an injury like that. It does really drag you down. And yeah, that sort of constant pain. It is your job, isn't it? And you've got a, you know, damaged finger. It's so much part of who you are as a cricketer, and it needs to be right. What can we expect from Ben Stokes? Is that an impossible question to answer? I mean, I've got sort of wind of this, that there's a possibility that he was going to turn up for the Ashes a couple of weeks ago. You hear the rumour mill, things start to come out.
I think we said it on this programme, actually.
Yeah, it's not entirely surprising when that news was released on Monday. Those of us who sort of, you know, hear whispers and things like that. Is it, for England, is it a huge psychological lift for those players?
Yes.
To have him there, is it a massive boost? Or you know, okay, it's one thing to have him, but of course there's no point having him if he doesn't, you know, produce any runs or wickets, you know, when push comes to shove in the test matches.
No, I think it's a huge psychological lift. I think it's massive for Joe Root, who I think, you know, was feeling a bit of a sort of lone warrior, really, and actually, you to use the word warrior is important, because Ben brings that confrontational sort of nature, in almost intimidating nature to the game. And he's so combative, he's so confident, he's so competitive. And you need that in Australia more than anywhere, where, you know, as soon as you arrive at customs, they're staring you down and going, well, you've got no chance, mate.
Yeah.
I've had that happen to me,
and I wasn't even playing.
Well, yes, I know, exactly. You'll get it again.
You might as well get back on the plane, mate. Well, you come to cover the England cricket team. No, mate, you might just go back home. We're gonna thrash you.
Yeah.
The customs officer said it to me when his dog came up to sniff my bag at the airport. And I'm not even playing.
Stokes thrives on that sort of thing. And so, undoubtedly, massively reassuring to Root as captain and, you know, star batsman that he's got, and now an ally in the team, and obviously to the rest of the side as well. We just mentioned Mark Wood's fragility fitness-wise. You've got Stokes there to bowl incisive overs, hopefully, and be aggressive and be in the faces of the Australians. So, and that's the key thing, really. Obviously, we know about his skill, all-round skill, his presence on the field, in the slips, and just, you know, goading his players, and, you know, perhaps kind of the odd line to the Aussies as well. He has that immense respect from the Aussies, who know what he can do, and that just is a massive lift to England in all ways.
Okay, Yoz, we're going to hear from Liam Plunkett after the break. We've had the first 9 matches of the tournament. Actually, I note that 8 of the 9 we've won so far by the teams batting second. We did our predictions a week or so ago. I think it's time to sort of just revisit our prediction for the semi-finalists. Who, after what you've seen so far, fairly early days, who are your 4 teams for the semi-final?
England, India, Pakistan, and Australia. And Australia getting there by the skin of their teeth.
Well, I wrote Australia off last week. I said I didn't think they would do particularly well in the tournament. But actually, I do think they'll make the semi-finals. I think those will be the 4 semi-finalists. Those are my 4 semi-finalists as well. So
I'd like to see Afghanistan in the semi-finals, but they can't obviously get in with India and Pakistan as well. I just think they've been really exciting, and what a wonderful fillip for them with all that's going on in their country. To play the way they've played and just to exhibit the skills they have actually as well. I mean, it's a tremendous boon to have them in the competition.
It is, although what I would say is that the only team they've beaten so far is Scotland. And Scotland did really well to qualify. They beat Bangladesh and they won all three of their preliminary group matches. But they've been found out. I'm not quite sure that's necessarily the right phrase, but they are at a level and other teams are above them. And Afghanistan are definitely above them. And their spinners sorted them out in that match of the day, 130 runs. It was a pretty chastening defeat. And then Scotland beaten by Namibia as well. So yeah, that's it for me, Oz. Next time we speak to you on this podcast, we'll revisit those predictions and see whether we still think those four teams are the most likely semi-finals. Yeah, I've sort of given Australia a reprieve. I thought about it after writing them off last week. I thought, they're going to win the tournament or something like that. So I put them back in my four for the semi-finals, but we'll see how that pans out.
So the guest in the Virtual Cricket Club the other day was Liam Plunkett. And in case you don't know what I'm talking about, this is a club we run every week to interview a leading player in aid of the Professional Cricketers Trust, the charity that supports players who've fallen on hard times. And we've had an absolute list of players over the year. And in fact, we're celebrating, Simon, our first birthday of the world's best cricket club, as we call it. Very modestly. And we've had pretty much some of the world's best players on it anyway. And Liam Plunkett clearly has been one of those over the last 4 or 5 years or so. I suppose the interesting thing for him is he's had to go through quite a career change because he's played in that World Cup winning side and been very much part of that team for 4 years. Then he was basically let go as England decided to move on, looking at his age and the long-term plans. He was moved out of that England One Day side. And he's tried his best to make a living from playing for Surrey in the domestic tournaments, but it hasn't kind of quite worked out for him. Injuries-wise hasn't helped. Obviously, age-wise, young players coming in. Again, perhaps Surrey also looking to the future a bit more. So he's decided now, and this has been quite well publicised, to move to America where his wife is from and where he's been living quite a bit over the last couple of years, to make a go of it in American cricket, because they really are starting to make moves in the shorter formats with both a minor league and a major league announced to start in the next year or two. And he's going to be very much part of that as coach and player. So it's an exciting, new chance for him.
Yeah, and we should talk about that. Should we start at the end, if you like, Yoz? When I say the end, I mean the end of Liam Plunkett's international career. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? His last game for England, you might say it's fantastic in a way, but I think that was obviously tinged with disappointment because he didn't play subsequently. Yeah, it was the World Cup final. It was that dramatic win by England in the Super Over. And Plunkett played an absolutely vital part in that whole campaign, the build-up, and in the campaign itself, and in the final. So a sort of odd way to end, really. I wonder how he reflects on it.
Yeah, honestly, it was amazing. It didn't feel like, in one aspect, it didn't feel like you were playing international cricket. It felt like you were playing with your mates. It felt like you would turn up to practice, and then all of a sudden you're on a big stage, international cricket, and everyone's watching you. But everyone wanted to get better all the time. And that was the thing. Everyone turned up, and the net sessions were tough. They were the hardest things. So when you went and played, that felt easier than the net sessions. Especially if you're bowling in the net practice and an open wicket. Obviously, you've got the nets on the side, open the roof and stuff like that. And you have Jason and Stokesy and Joss, all them guys. If you start missing, you're going to get fetched. It's going to end up in the crowd and you end up like a right muppet. So that was challenging. They were the hardest times, the net sessions, which made us better. Pretty much what happens with good teams. When I won the league with Durham, we had an amazing batting, and all the bowlers like Harmy, myself, Graham Onions, challenged the batsmen day in, day out. Same with Yorkshire, and that was the same with England. everyone just got tested every time they practiced. So when I went to the game, they've been in the situations before and faced the bowlers with pace or with spin, with variation. And it was one of the best things I've had so far in my life was to bowl first, and we bowl quite nicely. And then to put my flip-flops on and go on the balcony and just watch our guys bat front row, somewhere like Lords or Oval, where you've got a good feed. You probably treat yourself to some sticky toffee pudding, and then you get on the balcony and watch the guys go to work. It was nothing better, because stuff was happening in front of your eyes that's never happened before, like breaking records and the fastest 100, the fastest this, the fastest that. It was incredible 4 years, and it was so consistent. We got 300 so many times, and obviously to get 400 to break the world record, it was a joy to be involved in that. And it just went like that. And as I said, to win that World Cup at home at Lords the way we won it was, as I said, it was, to me, it felt like it was written in the stars. But it was an amazing journey that 4 years.
And for you, you were an important member of the team, not just for your playing ability, obviously, but I felt you got people down to earth occasionally. You had a bit of a reputation for sort of saying quite funny things and sort of making people sort of see sort of straight. For you're honest, aren't you? You're a direct person. And do you think that was an important aspect of the team, that you had lots of different characters who could all have an impact at different times?
I think so. I just try to be myself. I wasn't too up. I wasn't too down. I'll just speak to people. And you are playing for England. It is a high-pressured situation against good teams, and there's stuff on the line, but it is a game at the end of the day. We all started to play cricket for fun and enjoyment. So that was the thing for me, is I'm very lucky to be involved in this. I think the first time around with England, I thought to myself, I'm very fortunate to make this squad. I'm travelling to here, I'm travelling there. But the second time I was around, I felt like I'm good enough to play for this England team. I'm good enough to help win a game. And everyone in that dressing room felt the same about themselves. So I think sometimes in the dressing room, you just show that how positive it is. And we're lucky to be here and we're all good enough to win games. And it, as I said, it's so relaxing. We had team meals that weren't even planned. We go away to the West Indies and stuff and nothing would be organised. Then all of a sudden you'd have the whole team having dinner together, which is not that usual, you know. So it's stuff like that happened all the time, which just showed how close that team was.
And it must then have been extremely tough. And you've talked about it a bit, you know, to be not part of it anymore, and the come down from the World Cup final, and then you not playing for that team must have been really tough.
Yeah, I think it was what it was. I mean, it's just the way that was dealt with. I've spoken about this plenty of times. I just think the management could have done it better. I could have been spoke to a little bit better, but that's the way you're going forward. If you want to improve your teams, if you want to plan for the future, then you get new blood in. And sometimes you have to make sacrifices. If I was playing well at the time, they might have thought maybe in a year or two, you might struggle. So that's fine. Like that is what it is. That's sport. But as I said, it was just managed poorly. I miss being involved in them guys, because you're playing for the best team in the world, winning trophies. Like, who wouldn't miss that? And obviously you create good friendships and you're best mates are playing. I miss that sort of side of it, but I'm at a point now where I'm happy with what I've achieved. And if someone told me I'd play my last game for England and it was winning the World Cup, you know, I would have snapped the hand up.
Well, yeah, I mean, wonderful, wonderful experience. And you know, you had a massive part to play in that game as well. And who are you still kind of, you know, close with in that team? Is there a couple of players that you regularly see or talk to?
Yeah, I mean, we have a WhatsApp group still, the Champions WhatsApp group, where someone's birthday or someone, whatever, we all chirp in. But I speak to Woksy, I'm close to Woody, Johnny, Giroy. There's plenty of people that I can speak to. I wouldn't feel uncomfortable calling any of them for a conversation. But yeah, I'll chat to them. Woksy's in touch a little bit. So yeah, all the guys are pretty close. But yeah, I know when I was playing, as soon as you're in that bubble, like you're sometimes focused in a bubble and life goes on, doesn't it? But yeah, I've got a strong connection with most of them guys.
You haven't actually been together since, have you? I don't think you've been since the day after the final. I don't think you've all been together in the same place, have you? Is that right?
No, I think because they were trying to get ready for the test match against Ireland. So we may as well just, they may as well not went to the first day when they got cleaned up for nothing. We may as well just had a get together then and had the bus down Trafalgar Square or something. But hopefully, as you said, with upcoming events and stuff, we can all get back together.
Looking at the team now then, you've obviously watched a bit of the World T20. How do you think they're shaping up?
really well. Yeah, against, obviously, you've played the last two games and they've done well. Obviously, Tamar Mills has come back in, been successful. He came in, did well, did the IPL, did quite well out there, and obviously struggled a bit with injuries and come back, but he's performed well the last few years and in the 100. So he's, I think, massive to that team as well. I think he can take some wickets and do well in that. But yeah, obviously looking at Pakistan, they've obviously had the backs against the wall with what happened and people pulling out and that kind of stuff. They've played in Dubai and UAE a lot. I think they're going to be the team to beat, to be honest. But there's a massive chance for England. Why not? All the guys have travelled around the world and played in all these conditions. We've got an amazing players. So there's a great chance to go back to back.
So he recommends Pakistan as well as the team to watch in the tournament, so very much backing up what you thought right at the start. And I thought, you know, what he said about the success of that England one-day side, the World Cup winning side, was interesting. Not just about the skills on the field, but the way they were together, the way they were mates. And, you know, I've been making this documentary over the last year or so, interviewing a lot of the players in that World Cup side, and they all say the same thing, that there was this special bond between them, which they'd never really experienced in a team before. But also what Liam was talking about was that intensity of practice as well, playing together in the nets and challenging each other. And because it was such a strong team and there were so many different ingredients within it, they were improving each other all the time and kind of pushing each other. And I mean, I just remember that from playing for Middlesex, when Middlesex won a series of tournaments in the 1980s. You know, there were so many good players and we were all testing each other in the nets all the time. The nets themselves were very competitive. And, you know, that's what you need, is that constant dynamism within the team, but also getting on well together off the field. And that's where I think that England World Cup winning side were unique.
He played 124 times for England, 13 tests, 89 one-day internationals, 22 T20s. He's in his 37th year. He went out winning the World Cup. Was he hard done by, or did the selectors get it right, that actually all good things must come to an end?
I think he was a bit hard done by. I think he had... And he talks about this in the Virtual Cricket Club, actually, and it'll be an interview that I post on YouTube today. You can get to that if you go to the Analyst YouTube channel. And he talks about the subtlety of his bowling and the way he took wickets in the middle overs by subtle variations of pace, subtle variations of grip, working out each batsman's default way of catching up with the strike rate, or, you know, their typical shots, and being able to anticipate what they might do. And I think that would have been really valuable for England going forward. So even if he didn't play every game, I would have had him in the squad. I would have had him playing, you know, a few games, and perhaps having a Tom Curran, you know, one or two other players, maybe a Saqib Mahmood, someone like that, who would ultimately take over his role. I would have had them around as well. You know, remember Graham Swann in the Virtual Cricket Club saying, you know, Jimmy Anderson's best asset is his knowledge of the game now. Get him into the coaching setup as soon as he stops playing. Don't put him into Lancashire second 11 coach or whatever. Get him into the international environment where he can still have an impact. He still knows exactly what's going on and he can pass that on to the next generation. And I think that's where Liam Plunkett would have been valuable as a part-time player and part-time coach in that very sort of specific area of those middle overs.
Yeah, I suppose the problem for the selectors was they were looking at his age, weren't they? And they were thinking, well, where's he going to be in 4 years' time? And we've seen Jimmy Anderson's about to go to the Ashes at the age of 39. Liam Plunkett would have been, or will be, by the time of the next World Cup.
40, roughly.
Yeah, well, not quite as old as that. But yeah, about 38. So thinking, well, is that going to work for us? We're going to be playing a World Cup in India. It may work for them. It may not have done. So anyway, they took that decision. It did seem like a tough decision. I suppose selectors' job is to make tough decisions, tough calls, and some are going to agree with it and some aren't. And some players are going to feel very hard done by, and some are going to feel very happy or relieved that they've been given another opportunity. So what about the next step in his career? You talked about going to play in America. Mm. What sort of plans are there for cricket in America? I mean, there's going to be a T20 league, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Well, the initial plans are a minor league this year. Sorry, when I say this year, 2022, 27 teams in the minor league. And he's going to be in one of those teams. I think he's going to be playing for Philadelphians, which is quite near to where his wife lives and where Liam obviously lives in the winter. And he will be player coach for that side. And then emerging from that, the following year, I think, it's going to be either a 6 or 8 team T20 major league tournament in the States. They've already earmarked several cities, places like Houston and LA and so on, Dallas, for having teams. They've got baseball stadiums that are getting converted into cricket stadiums. There's a lot of money invested. The TV broadcast rights are sort of up for grabs, and there is a TV station called Willow TV, which is huge in the States and which covers cricket from all around the world and has a big following. You know, there's a massive South Asian community. I think something like 4 or 5 million Indians or South Asians living in the States who, you know, obviously cricket converts. And, you know, it's going to be a challenge to clearly get the American populace as a whole to take on cricket. And Liam was saying actually that, you know, when he talks about cricket to the white Americans when he's over there, you know, they say things like, oh, do you have a mallet? Because they're thinking of croquet, or are you on a horse? So, you know, their bafflement knows no bounds about cricket, but there is a lot of investment and enthusiasm happening in the States now. The ICC want to invest a lot of faith in the future of American cricket. Greg Barclay, who I interviewed, who's the chairman of the ICC, was saying to me the other day that they're planning to have a T20 World Cup co-hosted by the US and the West Indies in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
So there's a lot happening in that space.
Yeah, I mean, you need to be very careful when you say these things about mallets and horses, because you know we're going to have it in the 100 in a couple of years' time. There's going to be players riding out on horses to the middle. I mean, that's, you know, it's the inevitable next step. You know, what happens in the first in America comes over to England. So be very careful. So is the plan then in the US to have players from around the world? So it's not just going to be domestic US players. It's going to be, you know, they're going to bring in players from West Indies, where, you know, wherever.
Yeah, they're definitely. I mean, they've already signed Corey Anderson from New Zealand, who you may remember, I think, scored the fastest 100 in an ODI. He had temporarily held the record, or maybe he was second fastest ODI 100 in something like 32 balls. So, you know, he's obviously not in the New Zealand side anymore, but talented. And they will get some other international players, maybe some of them just past their best. Feels a bit like Durham, when Durham started, actually, and people like me were playing, you know, people slightly past their best to try and put the cricket on the map. I think they'll get some exciting talent. Obviously, in the end, they need to develop their own. In the meantime, they need to, you know, try and find the likes of Liam Plunkett and others who just finished their international careers and want a new kind of challenge, if you like, before they get too old.
Yeah, Corey Anderson, 131 not out of 47 balls was the innings you were talking about. He reached his 100 off 36 balls back in January 2014. Yeah, I mean, what they need ultimately are the top players, aren't they? The top stars. But then there's so much demand from all sorts of leagues around the world. They're going to have to divide them into two, aren't they? They're going to have to take a leg over to another leg over to the IPL.
I'll tell you what's going to happen, though, is that IPL franchises, maybe even Big Bash franchises, are going to start to invest in the US because the US is sport's richest market. You know, there is so much available capital there. They have many of the world's richest sporting franchises, the likes of Dallas Cowboys and, you know, the baseball franchises and so on. So it's a no-brainer for the game to try and get more interest. I think also the fact that the Americans now are legalizing sports betting has created a massive opportunity. Don't start, say, match fixing. Sports betting, the whole world of sports betting, brings in a lot more finance into sport. as we've seen in this country, and sport and sort of fantasy gaming and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity in America. I just want one other thing. A lot of the really big tech companies are run by people who were born in India, the Googles and the Microsofts and so on. There's a big interest in cricket and the technological connections with cricket, and you know, the fact that it's a game about numbers and data and so on. So that is also an area that will really help the game to grow.
So the 2050 T20 World Cup final between what, USA and China, do you think?
Listen, 2028 LA Games, yeah. Cricket is going to be part of that. I guarantee you've heard it here. I guarantee that's going to happen.
Right, Yoz, we've been talking for long enough today. We've been really enjoying the T20 World Cup. England making progress, Pakistan making progress. It'll be fascinating to see how it plays out. We've got England and Australia to look forward to on Saturday. And we've got, you know, Afghanistan.
I'll tell you what else we've got to look forward to. Next week in the Virtual Cricket Club, you know who our guest is, don't you?
I think it's Andy Zaltzman, isn't it?
It is. It's Andy Zaltzman. And we've been racking our brains to try and think of quiz questions that would stump him, because his knowledge of the game is ridiculous. So we've got to come up with some clever quiz questions. Maybe we give him the answers and he's got to work out the question.
he'd like that. I mean, if you think we're enthusiasts about cricket, then you've not seen anything yet. I mean, Andy Zaltzman is an absolute cricket nut. So, yeah, great to have Zaltz in the Virtual Cricket Club on Wednesday.
And you can join that by going to worldsbestcricketclub.com. And please join us, because we've got a sequence of other guests. Ian Botham's going to do a wine tasting.
Another one, is he?
Yeah, well, he roasted us for not doing his whites last time. He did the reds, but we didn't do the whites. So he's desperate to come on and talk about his white wine, apart from the Ashes, of course.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to that, Yoz. Thanks for joining us today. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and we'll speak to you again soon. Podcast Network.